Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lunar Crush Live. John, how are you doing this afternoon?
Good, Joe. How are you?
I'm doing good. Normally, we're in the mornings. This is nice. A little afternoon. I'm a little bit more awake. I'm feeling good. Today,
two coffees?
What was that? Two coffees?
Two coffees or, yeah, how many?
Oh, no, I'm probably already four in. I'm coming.
Are you serious?
I'm coming down now. I'm like, you know, got to go to like non-caffeinated tea.
Oh, man.
If the pot didn't end, I would just keep going. So welcome to episode 118. Today we've got Travis Kling, founder and chief investment officer of Ikigai. Known Travis for a long time. He's a great guy. I'm super excited to have him on and kind of hear his view of the world right now with everything going on with crypto and the markets in general. But we are going to learn about him and Ikigai and where the name comes from and all of that. This Thursday we've got Perina and Santiago from Flick Play, Web3 social app where you can unlock NFTs in the real world and create videos with them in AR. So it looks like we are dropping the metaverse tag from the startups in that space. I love it. Our disclaimer, as always, you know, we do not take payment for our live streams. We bring on fun, exciting people who have dedicated their careers to the space. Travis is definitely one of those guys. And so make sure you get in there, get that subscribe button going. We've got a bunch of great ones lined up for you. So let's hit that intro and let's do this. Travis, my man, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. How are we doing? That was a nice looking intro you guys had going on there too.
Thank you. I think I got to extend it just a touch because it's barely enough time to go and retweet the stream that's out there. So, but I appreciate it, man. So we always like to start the show. Where are you in the world and what's it like there today?
I'm in Austin, Texas, beautiful Austin, Texas. It is sunshiny. We just had a couple days of rain, which was much needed rain. Everybody's happy when we get rain in the summer in Texas, and beautiful down here in Austin. So
love it. Austin is just absolutely, you know, taken off in the last couple of years. And I feel like every time I talk to another person from California where John and I are at, they're either thinking Austin or Boulder or Nashville. And so it's kind of, I think, created a cool culture down there. And I love always going to the conferences. Little too hot for my liking, though. I don't know if I could do it. That consensus down there, man. I mean, you're on those little limes and you're just sweating, even though you're cruising on a lime. So
totally. Yeah. Well, I mean, if the only thing you're solving for is weather, then, you know, California is pretty much impossible weather isn't even a thing in Southern California. Right. Mm-mm. But, There are other considerations. So
awesome, man. Well, we've known you for a long time. You know, I don't even know if we've gone through your whole story about how you kind of got into crypto and, you know, the why behind why you're in this space, but I would love to hear, you know, a little bit more about you and your journey into crypto and what, you know, what made you jump in and be so passionate about it. And then we can learn a little bit more about Ikigai.
Yeah, so I had a career in traditional hedge fund investing, energy investing, mostly oil and gas, some power and alternatives. So I'm not a tech investor by background. Wasn't really much of a tech guy growing up or as an adult. You know, I guess neither one of those things are true now. But did 10 years in traditional finance. Worked at a hedge fund in Chicago called Magnetar Capital, doing long short energy equities and non-control private equity and debt in the energy space. And then after that, left and went to Point 72 in New York, was a portfolio manager there, running an energy and materials equities book, long short. And, you know, Bitcoin was just this thing that was like not really the type of thing that I paid attention to. And I heard about it for the first time when Silk Road got shut down in late 2013 and was just reading about that. And I was like, you know, I thought that the drug dealers had invented the money. I like didn't really under, I did like zero research. I thought that they, and I was just like, wow, they made this money to buy drugs on the internet. That is amazing. Wow. And then early 14, Mt. Gox got hacked. And I remember sitting there at Magnetar going, man, I'm glad I didn't buy any of this Bitcoin thing because I'm sure I would have gotten it all stolen. I stopped paying attention to it. And then fast forward to the back part of the end of 2016, price hit $1,000 again, and it just popped back up on my radar. And that time I got into the subreddits and the Bitcoin talk forums, and I didn't know what people were talking about because I still hadn't read the white paper. I like read the Wikipedia, and I had no idea what it was talking about. So I didn't know what they were talking about. But I was, just the quantity of people that were talking about things in there really caught my attention, and it like struck me as anti-fragile in the way that Nassim Taleb talks about anti-fragility. And then early 17, Ethereum and all the ICOs started going crazy. I, you know, read the term smart contract for the first time, read the Bitcoin white paper in May of 17, fell down the proverbial crypto rabbit hole. Summer 17. Started spending all my time, you know, reading about crypto, go to the gym, listen to a crypto podcast, go home, sit on the couch in the dark till 2 o'clock in the morning, read about crypto, wake up, do it all over again. And I had to start at the very beginning because I didn't know anything about cryptography and I didn't know anything about computer science. So just like, what is a hash? You know, what is a Merkle tree? How is it, you know, just the very foundational stuff. And 50 hours turned into 100 hours of self-study, turned into 200, turned into 300. And around 300 hours of self-study in like the end of September 2017, I just convinced myself that all this stuff was going to be a big deal and went into my boss's office. And I was like, I don't want to be an equity long short portfolio manager anymore. I'm going to make a career change. And I left Point72 December 17, decided to pursue crypto investing full time, thought about joining a project, like some kind of crypto project. Ended up deciding to start an investment fund that focused on crypto, spent basically 2018 in the bear market building that, you know, getting ready for launched Ikigai in December of 2018 in the depths of the bear market, right after that November 2018 market crash. You know, I think in that, like, why crypto? You know, I think for me, that answer has evolved over time. So like, if I go back and put myself in my own shoes in the summer of 2017, what was it? It was like coming across revolutionary concept after revolutionary concept, where I would read something and not understand it, and then, you know, do a bunch of foundational research to even get to like some minor level of understanding of what I was reading. And then I would go, I don't think that exists anywhere else in the world. Like, I don't think, you know, this has been done before. And it seemed like I kept kind of running across these things. And then I got this feeling from that because I wasn't a tech investor, not an early stage investor in my career, I wasn't really used to coming across investment ideas and being like, coming across like early stage ideas and being like blown away by them. That was not something that I like, you know, had a lot of experience with in my life. But one time in particular that I had that experience was I was living in Chicago and I took an Uber. Chicago was the second city that got Uber after San Francisco. So I took an Uber, I think like early 2012, when really nobody had ever heard of it. And a buddy of mine told me about it. I read an article about it. I downloaded the app. No, like it really was not making any kind of noise at all at that point. I download this app. It's black car only. It picks me up from my apartment. It takes me to like a store or something, drops me off on the sidewalk, drives away. And I remember standing on that sidewalk in the car driving away, and I was like, well, that's just going to change everything. And I just had this conviction around it that I just never had that kind of conviction. And afterwards, I used to joke around over the next few years that day I took that Uber, you know, obviously Uber went on to do what it did. And the day I took that Uber, I should have just quit my job and walked into Uber's office and said, I'll do whatever biz dev, CFO, whatever you needed me to do, just pay me in stock, right? And that would have been a great outcome. You know, I probably would have been the 50th employee or something like that. And that would have been a good outcome. And I used to half joke about that after that. And then the second time I ever got that feeling was really when I was that first couple hundred hours of self-study in crypto in the summer of 2017. So there was some like pattern matching to that. So I think in the moment it was that kind of thing. You know, I think the why decentralization, that was not well formed for me at that was not very well formed for me at that time. I had this like sneaking suspicion that, and I didn't really understand how Bitcoin would play into this as I came to understand more in the world, sort of the world has evolved in how it views Bitcoin over the last 5 years. But I did have this feeling that, because I graduated grad school in 2008. So I got out of school in 08. I was interviewing I went into investment banking, and I was interviewing for investment banking jobs as the beginning of the financial crisis was happening. I was like interviewing with Bear Stearns right before they blew up. I interviewed with Lehman, like 9 months before they went bankrupt, and then started my career in July 2008 in investment banking, and got the financial crisis right in the face, and then saw all the stuff that happened in terms of monetary and fiscal policy in response to the financial crisis. And I understood all of that well, and then I went to a hedge fund that made and this is all publicly available information, I went to a hedge fund that made a tremendous amount of money shorting subprime, not while I was there, but afterwards. And so I was working at this organization that had, really been heavily involved in all of this. And like a lot of guys in finance that are about my age and started their career around my time, I think a lot of guys have this sneaking suspicion that like all of this shit is rigged and like it's broken, and that all became clear in the aftermath of the financial crisis, and that we're now 14 years on from that, and we're kind of still in that trade, amazingly, 14 years later, that like now the Fed is the only thing it's the only thing that matters for asset prices. That's it, right? And I had this sneaking suspicion back then, and I didn't really know what to do about it, or how it was going to kind of develop. But, I think a lot of people about my age that went into a career in finance had this thing in the back of your head where you're going, markets aren't working the way they're supposed to. This is nothing like what we learned in school. This is nothing like the way markets are sort of free market. Like, that's not what's going on here. So, yeah.
No, it's an awesome story. And yeah, I didn't know your 2008 story. We have a very similar path right there with going into investment banking and then realizing that, these companies that were 100-year-old institutions are now just gone. And there were a couple of winners and losers that were just chosen, based on some of those funds that were out there. And I wanted to ask this one a little bit later, but it kind of like went right into it. It's almost like from a macro standpoint, everything is almost mute, right? We have like a variety of factors that are out there that the markets and economies are on they're tiptoeing through, and there's this field of landmines of things that can happen at any moment, right? And then one landmine is going to go off and all these other factors are going to happen. If Russia happens over here, if China happens over here, if inflation does this thing happens, and inflation's almost kind of like an earnings report at this point. It's like, who cares if it's 8.6? If it's less than 8.6, that's a good thing, right? Where 8.6 a year ago would scare the shit out of everyone. Right. But like what I want to talk about is what makes crypto an investable asset again, like uncorrelated, because like what untethers us from the rest of this? Because the fact that like Jay Powell has a rate hike, right? And that's affecting like Cardano and everything else is acting the exact same, just to me doesn't feel like what you described at the beginning of your story of I joined this because of the double spend problem was solved and the innovation that's going to be proliferate because of that. We're now in an era where, hey, the Fed's going to make a rate hike and that's going to affect like altcoins and layer ones and Bitcoin all at the same time.
Yeah. So what you're speaking to there is like, it's all one trade and don't fight the Fed. These adages that have been in place for you know, Don't Bite the Fed's been in place for a long time. It's All One Trade's been in place for kind of, you know, going on 2 years now, over 2 years. And I think that just speaks to just that overwhelming hand that monetary and fiscal policy now has on asset prices, you know, in a world that has become, you know, global financial markets that have become so debt laden, that any kind of sort of deflating of the balloon, you know, basically no asset class can be spared from that. You know, I think commodities, you could have a more nuanced discussion about commodities within all of those different asset classes, but they have a very unique set of circumstances that are going on with the Ukraine conflict situation. And I'm not sure that that's set to end anytime soon. In terms of the Fed's and central banks in general stranglehold on asset prices, that's just probably going to continue to be in place until you have, you know, some very real reset. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly what that's going to look like. I don't think it's like on the near term horizon. So maybe we don't have to worry about it too terribly much right this second. Can probably kick the can for a few more years or a decade or something like that. But in terms of the investment case for crypto, you know, I split out Bitcoin and then kind of everything else, because I think Bitcoin is competing to be money. It's just sort of in a category by itself. And that's not to say that I don't think ETH can potentially become money, because I think it can. And it's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out, but it's not right now. You know, Bitcoin is this non-sovereign, hard cap supply, global, immutable, decentralized, digital store of value. That's six adjectives. That's a lot of adjectives, but each one of those is important. And it's an insurance policy against monetary and fiscal policy irresponsibility from central banks and governments globally. And it needs sort of, Bitcoin loves QE and detests QT. It needs this like egregiously irresponsible monetary policy and fiscal policy to act as this forcing function for increasingly more capital to flow into this alternative store of value. And it's gonna ebb and it's gonna flow with QE and QT. And it's, you know, probably not going to be the sort of like years of an uncorrelated asset. Its correlation to macro is going to ebb and flow, but it's going to generally trend towards becoming more, more correlated and increasingly more wrapped up in macro. I think that's an inevitability of Bitcoin as it gets bigger and more sort of globally systemically important. You know, I would almost be worried if you told me that Bitcoin, you know, a couple of years from now was totally uncorrelated, because my knee-jerk reaction to that would be the price must be very low for it to be able to act like that. But and so in terms of that value proposition for Bitcoin as this like alternative store of value, or like another way that I like to think about it is pristine collateral, which is this moniker that people have coined for Bitcoin. And I've been thinking about it like that for, I can't remember the first time I heard that. I don't even remember the first person I heard say that. Maybe Dan Tapiero, Raul Paul, I know, has talked about it like that. But maybe 18 months ago or so, I heard that, started thinking about it, started making more sense to me, because the US dollar is the world reserve currency, but in a debt fueled global financial system like the one that we have, U.S. treasuries are the collateral foundation for the global financial system. And it's the interest rate of treasuries that set the interest rate for everything else on planet Earth. And sort of like the attitude of risk in general, just sort of ground zero is treasuries. And then it just sort of expands out from there to everything else. And if you were going to look objectively at the financial instruments that is U.S. Treasuries, and you project out a couple decades, that is a financial instrument that has problems over the next few decades, objectively. And so as the world starts to look around and say, well, you know, where else might we think about something else for collateral? That's a very short list. It's a really crappy list.
Yeah.
Like what are we going to, use European Union debt? Like, are you kidding me? No. We're going to use JGBs? No. Are we going to use Chinese sovereign? Like, no. And like, you just start, look, can we use gold? Yeah, maybe. It's really weird, right? It's like an element on the periodic table. Also, central banks already own all of it. So, like, I'm not sure how well it works to sort of, like, act as a hedge against central bank action when central banks have more of it than everybody else. And that doesn't make that much intuitive sense to me. So, like, you know, and then I think you couple that with eventually boomers, you know, are going to be out of power and control, and millennials are going to be in power and control. And you sort of tie all that together, and the likelihood, you know, I think the investment case for Bitcoin is that it sort of, like, over the course of this decade marches slowly towards chipping away at U.S. Treasuries, you know, sort of like stranglehold on the market share that is sort of pristine collateral. And it's not like I think we're going to wake up in 2030 and, like, Bitcoin's going to be the collateral foundation for the world. That's not my base case at all. But if we just kind of make progress over that period of time, you know, I think that'll be good for Bitcoin. You know, the market value of all the treasuries in existence right now is, like, I don't know, 25 trillion or something like that. And that number is obviously definitely going higher. So that's Bitcoin. And then I think I would move over to, like, layer one smart contract platforms. And you sort of ask about the investment case for that. And I think that's the way I think about that is, like, you know, humans are becoming increasingly more intertwined with technology. That certainly looks like a trend that is, you know, set to continue. You know, that's a pretty safe bet, it feels like, at this point. And you look at big tech and you look at the centralization of the internet. And you just sort of objectively ask yourself the question, is the centralization of big technology causing societal problems? Yes or no? I think the answer to that question is yes. And then you go, well, is there a chance that decentralization has the potential to alleviate some of those societal problems that have been coming from the centralization of big technology? Yes or no? I think the answer is yes. And so then it seems like that's probably something that's worth working on as technology, you know, gets more and more intertwined with humanity and our lives become increasingly more just totally governed by technology. And it's kind of interesting that when you go back to the cypherpunk days at the beginning of the internet, you know, there's this little group of computer nerds that were, this is what they were saying at the very beginning. Right. They were like, you should not make this centralized. You should make it decentralized. There's all these problems with centralization. Look, it's centralized tech companies are, like, very easy to hack. See, look, we can hack it like this. We can hack it like that. You know, you fast forward a couple decades and there's still, you know, hacks left and right. And it's not to say that there aren't hacks in crypto either. But, you know, so, you know, we decided to build the internet in a centralized manner because the world wanted to scale it very quickly, like, bring, you know, and bring it to the world, and companies wanted to create businesses around that, and they did, and they became enormous and very profitable. So I get all that. But now you sort of, like, fast forward to where we are today and you go, like, maybe it's a better idea if we try and rebuild, you know, aspects of this with more decentralization in it. And I think that to me is, like, the very basic premise for this. And you need, in the same way that for Bitcoin, you need egregious monetary and fiscal policy to act as a forcing function for the world to sort of look around for alternative monies, alternative stores of value, you need big tech companies to be doing things that piss off humans to act as a forcing function for humans to go look around for like what else is there? Like, what other options are there out there? And yeah, you know, we've had some of those, and I think we're probably going to continue to have some of those. And then we'll see, you know, how much humanity ends up caring about that. And, you know, if sort of like, you know, that caring factor is sort of like slowly going up and to the right like this, and, you know, maybe we can get the slope up a little bit more like that. And that needs to intersect with like, well, how ready is the technology for the world, right? And like, you know, Ethereum, it's like way too expensive to transact on it, right? And, you know, this whole private key thing is, you know, kind of a mess in terms of user experience. And, you know, there's still a lot of things we got to work out. But, you know, if how ready is the tech for the world intersects with how ready is the world for the tech, you know, at the right time, well, then, you know, we could potentially have a shift that happens, you know, relatively rapidly. So I think that's where we are right now at that. And then the last thing I would say is just, you know, a bunch of these other use cases, you know, they're much more experimental. You know, you can throw out one-liners like, okay, is social media causing problems? You know, yes. Would decentralized social media potentially alleviate those problems? Yes. You know, gaming, you know, yes. Metaverse, you know, I think metaverse is an interesting one to probably talk about, and it still kind of falls into the bucket of like, you know, okay, humans are becoming increasingly more intertwined with technology. This sort of like, in my opinion, the likelihood that we're moving generally towards a Ready Player One world, that looks like pretty likely to me. We can argue about the timeline of that. It looks pretty likely to me, and whether or not that's dystopian like Ready Player One or something more utopian or you know, something middle of the road with pluses and minuses, I think remains to be seen. But, you know, Facebook changed their name to Meta, and sort of just like objectively, do you want Zuck in charge of this world in the future? Like, I don't know. I don't really think that's probably the best outcome for anybody. So having, you know, decentralization be the foundational component of that strikes me as something, you know, worth working on.
A lot there. I want to ask you a kind of a question off of that. What do you think makes a good investor? And would you like self-describe yourself as an investor, as an economist, as a, you know, you got a little bit of a philosopher in there? And then who are some of the, like, the folks that you look up to when you think about decision making and where to kind of start to kind of put your focus with, you know, because I know you have like you had the Bitcoin fund, you know, now you're kind of branching out a little bit to the other fund. You know, what is your kind of, what do you self-describe yourself as?
Yeah, so Ikigai is now two different funds. We've got a hedge fund, which was the one we launched in December 2018. It wasn't a Bitcoin fund, but what we have done for most of the last few years with most of our capital has been systematic models driven exposure to Bitcoin with the purpose of outperforming holding Bitcoin through cycle.
Right.
So, you know, what does that mean? And, you know, it means we build proprietary statistical models and try and figure out when Bitcoin's undervalued or overvalued on kind of a, you know, medium time frame basis. And if you can do that reasonably well, you know, not perfectly, Lord knows we don't do it perfectly. If you can do it reasonably well, as the months turn into quarters, you can start compounding your outperformance versus just holding Bitcoin. And that's what we've done. And that now the hedge fund is kind of branching out into other stuff. We're trading ETH systematically as well too. And then, you know, starting to do more kind of qualitative fundamental type of things as well too out of the hedge fund. And then in May, we launched a venture fund as well too, you know, that is now focusing on, you know, the earliest stage emerging crypto sector, multi-year, you know, type of venture bets. And maybe we can talk more about that later. I guess I do describe my, you know, I do think of myself as an investor. For some reason, valuing things is like a term that, which I think is what, I think that's what it means to be an investor, but there's, I always just think about, I think it's because there's been a lot of continuity in my life. Like, I took my first upper level finance class my junior year in college, and then I never did anything else other than value things. You know, since I was like 20 years old. I'm 37 now, and I did it in a bunch of different asset classes, and did it up and down the capital structure, and did it in super liquid stuff, did it in totally illiquid stuff. I've done it, you know, sort of long short where you're beta neutral, you know, and I've done it, you know, leaning long. And it's just like valuing things, you know, why should an asset, you know, be priced any, you know, one thing and or another price. And I think I'm still doing that, you know, and doing that sort of quantitatively in Bitcoin with like a, you know, mid-range stat arb with a discretionary overlay strategy, which is, you know, how I would characterize what we've been doing in the hedge fund. That's a very nuanced way to do that. You know, and it's different than making early seed stage venture investments in crypto. But at the end of the day, you're still, you know, just investing at some valuation and, you know, thinking that that valuation is, you know, might be too low and that it's an attractive risk adjusted bet to make. You know, I think risk adjusted returns is a concept. I think a framework that I've spent, you know, my whole career in and continue to think about that today. And it's very different when you think about risk adjusted returns and the concept of, in the context of investing in like, you know, mezz debt of a publicly traded energy company, which I have done, versus risk adjusted returns of, you know, shit coining versus levered long Bitcoin exposure, right? Those are two different risk adjusted frameworks, but it's at the end of the day, it's still risk adjusted. Gosh, what makes a good investor? This is true, I think, across asset classes. It feels extra true in Bitcoin. There's so much noise in crypto. There's an incredible amount of information. And I think taking the fire hydrant of information and trying to pick out the couple things that are the things that really matter, that I think that is one of the most foundational things. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard. But investing is very hard, which is why the guys that are good at it, you know, if you just think about like free market economics, okay, well, the planet Earth tells you that if you're a very good investor, the world is going to pay you more money to do that than they're going to pay anybody else to do anything else, basically, right? Outside of like, you know, founding a technology company that gains mass adoption, that's the only thing that the world tells you is sort of like worth more than being really good at investing, right? And both those things are extraordinarily difficult to do. So you just have to be cognizant that you're trying to do something that's very, very hard. And, you know, I think sifting through the noise in crypto, it just depends on what level of seriousness or time you're going to do that. Are you doing this on nights and weekends? Okay, well, then your ability to do that is going to be pretty limited. And, you know, finding simplistic rules like just dollar cost averaging, you know, using like the Mayer multiple for Bitcoin, for example, and dollar cost averaging in and out of that, or maybe you never sell and you just sort of buy more when price goes down a lot, that kind of thing. You know, maybe that's the best approach to it. And then, you know, if you're going to do it professionally, then you need to have all kinds of tools and frameworks and, you know, a team. You know, we got a whole team of people that help me do my job. Everybody's got different roles. Everybody's got different skill sets. And you know, you got to go build a whole framework for that. And, you know, you can do that both quantitatively and qualitatively. That's how we do it in our business. We do a lot of things quantitatively. That is like lots of noise trying to find signal. And then there's, you know, lots of crypto specific qualitative stuff, a lot of noise trying to find the signal. And then, you know, there's this macro overlay of all of that, a lot of noise trying to find the signal.
I got a question around, I mean, obviously we, that's exactly what we do. We sort through the noise out there and we track all the social activity out there, across coins, NFTs, and other things in the future. When we look at what we're tracking, you know, you might look at the price of Bitcoin or any of the crypto assets out there and go, yeah, there's no one talking about crypto anymore. We actually see the inverse. We see that there's more people talking about it now, which, you know, even for us was surprising. I mean, we just had record activity in terms of social posts that we tried. We tracked, I think, a week ago. It was an all-time high. So it continues to go up. And, you know, I want to go back to your original story about getting started in crypto, because it made me think, you know what, like when we see the social activity that we see, there's another Travis out there right now getting started. You know, there's someone that's going right along your exact path right now. And they're popping onto crypto Twitter. They're going onto Telegram. They're going onto Reddit. They're, you know, I don't know, they're 87 Discords at this point. It's pretty wild out there. You know, considering that there's so many new faces that are still entering this space, you know, you must get hit. I know we do. Like you must get hit all the time with new people that are just getting in. And you know, you had a really awesome story about, you were very calculated. You spent so many hours researching Bitcoin and then you went to the next thing. And then you just, it seems like you're still never stopping with your research. How do you tell all these new people what to do? Like, where do they get educated?
Well, yeah, again, I would just go back to whether, are you going to do it full time or are you going to do it nights and weekends? Yes or no? I mean, I'm obviously biased, but I think anybody that listens to this that's not doing crypto full time should just quit whatever it is that they're doing and go into crypto. And I just point blank, I have a high conviction around that. I know everybody has their own situations they got to deal with. If you got a family, there's you know, financial considerations to take into account there. But I think that's an extremely attractive risk adjusted bet to make with your career, you know, almost regardless of where you are. And then, you know, and then if you're going to do it nights and weekends, then you really are talking about a relatively short amount of time that you've got dedicated to it. And I think, listening to podcasts, but you got to take some notes. That's the thing, is like the retention is so low on podcasts. If you're not taking any notes, because now I got a whole team. So the whole information aggregation synthesis, it's different for me now than it was then. Then I used Evernote and I had all of these notes and all of these links that I would paste. I don't spend that much time on Medium anymore, but when I first got started, I was spending all of this time on Medium, reading about all kinds of different things. And you know, you got to be organized, you know, with your information intake and synthesis, if you're going to have a snowball's chance of, you know, actually getting on some firm footing. And then, it's why I measure it in that raw hours. I don't think there's any way to get around that raw hours component. And when I, you know, from time to time, somebody from traditional finance will reach out. They'll hear about my story. They'll be crypto curious. They want to talk to me about it. And one of the first things I ask people when I talk to them is, I go, how many hours have you done? You know, is it 50? Mm-hmm. Is it 100? Is it 300? Is it 5? And I find that most people don't actually think about it like that. They have to like think, oh, well, I spent a couple hours here. But it is like there's a raw hours component to it, which is true about anything you're trying to do. You want to run a marathon? There is a raw hours component to training for a marathon that you cannot get around. And I think there's a raw hours component. If you're 50 hours into it and you're trying to decide whether or not you want to quit your day job and go into crypto, the first thing I tell people is, I go do another 200 hours and then come back to me. That's what I tell everybody. So there's so many great resources out. You know, the podcast, the podcast landscape is outstanding now. There's a lot of great newsletters out there. So it's, you know, there's never been more quality information that is available for $0 and 0 cents for you. So it's just up to you about whether or not you want to put the time in.
So on that same path, you know, what typically comes up is, oh, cool, I'll just set up an account on this exchange and buy some Bitcoin. And so how do you deal with, you know, people coming in and learning about custody? And I guess let's bring that all the way up to the institutional side. How do you look at custody from the institutional side as well?
I tell most people that they're probably, it is a, it's a individual decision about what your best custody solution is. I have no doubt that there are plenty of not your keys, not your coin people that are, you know, would disagree with me on this. And I think that's fine. I think for most people, keeping your crypto on Coinbase or FTX, those are the two exchanges that I trust. Keeping them on exchange with best practices is a better overall situation than cold storage. You need to have cold storage set up, and you need to practice it and be comfortable with it so that if something does happen, you can rapidly, you know, if the risk profile for Coinbase changes for some reason, you can pull your stuff off quickly. But for most people, the USB stick that's got everything that you have on there, and if you lose it, it's gone. If you lose your password, it's gone. That's just not, I think, the ideal setup for a lot of people. And again, that is a risk adjusted evaluation as well too. What are the chances you lose your USB stick or you lose your password versus what are the chances that Coinbase experiences a hack and you don't get made whole, or somebody hacks somebody gets into your account and drains your account specifically, you know, and weighing those things. And that's why you really got to have best practices for it, because in my opinion, the best practices for custody on exchange, to me, swing it in favor of keeping it on exchange for a lot of people. And again, I know there's people that really disagree with that. You know, so that's kind of my view. And it's basically never text, you know, 2FA, SMS 2FA, never use, right? You know, you need to have Google Authenticator. You should not keep your Google Authenticator on the phone that you walk around with. You know, there's a bunch of things that, you know, I don't want to hijack this conversation, but, you know, best practices, this is all available, you know, online for free. If you just Google, you know, custody best practices, you know, exchange best practices, you know, all this kind of stuff. So, yeah.
So what about on the institutional side though? Like, you know, you're seeing corporations holding mass amount of crypto now, and like some, and it's going to
they're going to use third party custodians. They just are, right? And I don't think that's not going to change anytime soon. And they're going to use, you know, Coinbase custody or Anchorage, and I think those are both great products. And institutions are going to want the system of checks and balances. You know, institutions just aren't going to keep it on a USB stick in a filing cabinet somewhere. So
I hope not.
I did want to talk a little bit. I mean, you know, we're entering like an interesting time in the market, right? Like we're talking about the Fed, we're talking about rates, inflation, you know, we've got a lot of conflicts potentially out there. But I still want to go back a little bit to like that narrative, right? Like what is, like, is there going to be like in your eyes, like, is there some, like, how do we get out of this from a crypto like narrative perspective, right? Like when we've gone through the narrative of, you know, crypto is a, you know, is a risk off asset and it's a strategic hedge, you know, against all these other things going on. I think what we've learned is, you know, it's still a little early for that, right? Like you kind of outlined this world where, you know, at some point,
I don't know who told you that Bitcoin was a risk off asset, but
that was, you know. I'm, you know, I'm not going to name too many names, but that was the narrative, you know, for a lot of the Bitcoiners, a lot of large podcasters, a lot of people out there pitching pension funds saying, hey, you're going to need a systematic hedge when inflation and all the, and the stock market goes down, you're going to need this. Right. And that they didn't, all they had was a 3-year history of Bitcoin kind of all over the place. And, you know, that's been proven incorrect. Right. And so I'm not sure what they're telling those pension funds and those large funds anymore, but that was like this narrative. There's this narrative that, hey, there's only, you know, 21 million of these things, X amount are already lost, you know, all of this going on, you're going to need one of these. But now, and then, you know, layer ones are the next internet, right? And the layer one wars, and hey, we have this new internet and you want a piece of the internet. You couldn't own the internet when the internet came out before, but now you can. One of these is going to win. I'm going to diversify across that. And then all of these tokens on top of layer ones are, hey, these are the new startups, but now the total addressable market of all of those is instantly 5 billion people versus just the 7x7 San Francisco Uber model, you know, who has to expand. And so there's all these things that, you know, there's, I still think like maybe the token side of that holds true a little bit, the layer one side, maybe a little bit, Bitcoin, not so much, but right now we're sitting here just completely correlated to the rest of the market. Is there a breakout? Like, is there like, you know, like right now, like subnets and everyone as their own standalone blockchain seems to be this thing, but I don't know if that is the next breakout. But just wondering from your perspective, where you think we are in the next just like 6 to 8 months of like, where does this narrative come from? And do we even have one?
Yeah. So I have been saying publicly for a few months now that Bitcoin's value proposition is the most challenged that I've seen it since I've been doing this. In 5 years, it was not an inflation hedge, a CPI inflation hedge. I never would have said that. You can't find me saying that publicly, but people did say that. And it was not uncorrelated. And that one in particular is a real ding for institutions. Because that was the big pitch, because you could, this was a chart that a lot of crypto folks that were pitching institutions, everybody had the page about if you just had a 2% position in Bitcoin over this period of time, you know, your returns went like this, but your, you know, sort of realized volatility didn't do anything because it's such a small percent of your portfolio. So your Sharpe ratio went up, right? And everybody, from an asset allocator perspective, right? That was very straightforward. And now it's not acting like that. And people are just going to have to, you know, I think the market is coming to grips with probably broadly speaking, how much don't fight the Fed is now in control. Because your home price didn't really act like that either this time around. I mean, look at the housing market. The housing market, it went straight this way. And then the second that the Fed turned around in November of last year, it just went like that. And if we keep tightening, then it's just, you're going to cause a housing market crisis. You're gonna crush the housing market. It's already getting crushed.
Right.
And it's true for, you just did it, you know, the 60-40 portfolio has gotten obliterated this year, right? So okay, now that doesn't work anymore because of the Fed. And NASDAQ went down 30% in a straight line, right? Including, you know, Apple, even though Apple just had this killer rally, but like, you know, Apple went down a lot too. These big tech companies, the biggest ones are, you know, about as good of a store of value as you can possibly imagine at this point, but they can't stand up to, monetary policy tightening at, you know, with where we are in this. And that's just the backdrop that investors are dealing with right now. But, you know, I think the flip side to that is that it would be my base case that Bitcoin, sorry, there's one other thing I'm going to say too about the challenges Bitcoin's narrative investment proposition, which is when you drill down into crypto specifically, you know, Bitcoin sort of badly underperformed on the way up in this most recent bull cycle. And it hasn't outperformed that much on the way down, which that hurts as well too. It has outperformed, but not to the same degree.
Yeah.
And that's a bit of a ding as well too. Now, it would be my base case that Bitcoin is going to outperform equities once the Fed goes on pause or slows down or starts, you know, cutting rates instead of hiking, which is, you know, on the table for next year. And, you know, it's my base case that Bitcoin will outperform the NASDAQ on the way up. And that, you know, alts in general will outperform Bitcoin. So it's just everything is now acting in this beta type of way. And I'm not sure what and that just may be the setup that's in place. But it's a setup that both for Bitcoin and for the rest of crypto also has a lot of really great tailwinds, right? Mm-hmm. Like a lot of really good tail. You know, there's this eye-watering amount of venture capital that's pouring into this space to try and build these things that are going to gain mass adoption. All of these nuances that we talked about earlier about, you know, why does the world need a decentralized store of value? You've got those tailwinds. You've got demographic tailwinds, right? Like the surveys are very clear. The older you are, the more sense you think gold makes, the less sense you think Bitcoin makes. The younger you are, the more sense you think Bitcoin makes, the less sense you think gold makes. You've got this, what they're calling, you know, the sort of great wealth transfer of, it's like $70 trillion of wealth or something that's going to go from baby boomers to millennials, you know, over the course of this decade.
Straight into altcoins.
I mean, yeah, there's every indication that it's like, okay, your parents died, you got the lake house, you sell the lake house, and you're going to buy a Bored Ape, right? Or whatever, right? I mean, there's a lot of indication that's what it's going to look like. And,
totally.
And I think it also, for the younger generation, like it's like crypto's our thing, right? So it's like, we want to put money into our thing. We don't want to put money into your thing. And if the stock market and crypto is going to be correlated anyways, well, let's just invest in our thing. Because the Fed's not going to stop going burr, right? It's one of probably the single strongest meme that came out of the response to COVID is money printer go burr. That's not a crypto meme. That is a global or at least nationwide meme that everybody understands really well. And when the printer goes burr, crypto goes up a lot. You know, there's a lot of tailwinds. So
I think that's an accurate, you know, analysis of what's going on for sure. You know, the next generation has to carry that torch, and they're going to carry it really in their own way. And, you know, I think the lesson there is, you know, the difference between that now and, you know, maybe 2018, early 2019, when we were both, you know, raising capital and starting these things, you know, is it going to even be there? Right. And now you're saying, well, like, the assumption is, and the baseline is that, yeah, it's going to be there. And here's potentially the beta of how it's going to be correlated in these certain ways. Like that's a huge difference than where we even were 3 years ago.
I've been talking about that a lot. I mean, we've crossed the Rubicon in terms of very significant amounts of global capital coming to understand whether or not this asset class is attractive as an investment case. Like, it's like the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah.
This is a extremely investable asset class that is going to garner increasingly more capital, and it is subject to the whims of central bank monetary policy, just like every other asset on planet Earth, just like your home, right? But in terms of relative to the prior bear market cycle, when hardly any financial capital at a large scale was paying any attention to this thing at all, and the people that were paying attention to it didn't know what to think about it, didn't know if there was anything worth anything in any of this stuff. Like that we've moved past that at this point. That definitely bodes well.
You know, on the note of transitioning into this new world, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, Wall Street. We got all these public companies. They got quarterly earnings. you know, they're completely and totally regulated versus the crypto market. What happens when, you know, these companies, they're doing sort of, a lot of public companies are doing some sort of blockchain initiatives. They're not like getting rid of their stock and transforming to a token or anything like that yet. But I'm curious how you see this evolving. I mean, we got the stock market that, you know, it's got operating hours that open and close. We've got crypto markets that never sleep. We've got public companies that have a stock. Do you see this kind of transformation of public companies moving into crypto? And then if so, where does that value go? Like if a public company were to have a token, does the value of the entity go to the token or to the earnings, the bottom line, right, the stock?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure how to think about it. You know, I think there's another knock on Bitcoin. The public company balance sheet experiment, you know, I think we're mostly done with that. I guess never say never. Things can change very rapidly, but you know, that was an experiment that got a little bit of traction, never really got off the ground, and then, you know, hasn't really worked out all that well. And I would be surprised if there were very many public companies that are, you know, on the verge of buying Bitcoin on their publicly traded balance sheet now, for a few different reasons. In terms of like sort of the real world adopting this technology and this asset class, I think it's probably easier for me to imagine that we grow our own ecosystem stuff that gets so big that it just starts to like eat the rest of the world basically, and like instead of the adoption thing, I guess it's easier for me to imagine that, because I think you have this like innovator's dilemma thing that is going to be in place at least for the next few years, and it seems to be in place in a few different places. One of the things I'd think about is like the traditional gaming space's reticence to sort of embrace crypto that much. There are, you know, pretty high quality game studios that are trying some stuff out, but there's also a pretty good amount of pushback from traditional gaming. And I think that it strikes me as like a pretty classical innovator's dilemma type of, you know, status quo versus the up and comer type of situation. So, I don't know. I struggle to see. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of companies that are trying to figure out how to use like block, you know, sort of like blockchain, not Bitcoin. Like people still have not put that to bed yet, you know, and I, that still continues to be, you know, just entirely not interesting to me. A blockchain is a poorly performant database, and if you don't need decentralization, there's just so many better options than a blockchain. And it's like, what do you need decentralization for? Well, if you don't have a good answer for that, then the blockchain is probably not a very good answer for you. And, you know, having a decentralized, I don't know how you have a decentralized, it's like, okay, well then, so then it's like, what do you need decentralization for, and how decentralized is decentralized enough? And at a certain level of decentralization, it's my belief that you have to have a token that acts as the mechanism designed to coordinate incentivization. And if you're trying to somehow like navigate this, I want a blockchain and maybe it's a little decentralized, but there's no token. I don't know, that's very murky waters there. So,
or your token goes up because it did so well, but wait, it wasn't in dollars. So then what, you have to sell your token. So then it falls to zero. So then like, wait, that doesn't make sense. That's not sustainable. So it's interesting. Like when you start to think about, I think you're dead on. Like when you start to think of like a a public company or a corporation really transforming into this kind of decentralized world. That seems really difficult. You're seeing it with Facebook, with Meta. You're seeing it with Meta and versus like, say, Sandbox. Look at Sandbox. They're just like, every day there's another announcement. It's crazy. Yeah. You know, Decentraland, you look at this stuff going and they're just jamming because they don't have these handcuffs.
Right. Yeah, and like, you know, it's very early for DAOs, but if you fast forward through the rest of this decade, I mean, I'm pretty bullish on DAOs. And that's, and I think that that speaks to my point about instead of the real world adopting this technology and evolving accordingly, it's like, what's the likelihood that you just have DAOs start to replace corporations as a superior form of human coordination? Like, you know, that ain't, that's not 2022 that's going to happen. But to my point, you know, it's like, okay, you fast forward to the end of this decade and into the next, and that, and millennials are now pulling the trigger everywhere. Then that starts to get pretty interesting, in my opinion. So
I agree with both you guys. And I think where we're kind of seeing it, you know, because Bitcoin doesn't have that use case, you know, I feel like it's still complicated in the balance sheet, but I will say, you know, our memories are so short, and like, especially in the US here, where someone else is going to try it in the next bull market and go do it potentially. But I think it's going to be a lot harder. But I think where you're seeing it is, I mean, look at what Nike's doing with NFTs, right? Or if you want to, if you're XYZ company and you're going to go run this massive, you know, and you want to stay true at, you know, to the space, you're going to say, hey, we're going to go do it the right way. Tokens now are going to unlock this hotel room or whatever. NFT is going to go unlock that. Now suddenly you have to hold potentially a lot of ETH on your balance sheet, right? Or whatever, you know, layer one you decide to work with it on. So they're going to have to figure it out, I feel like, in different ways. It's going to be a different way to kind of hold that. And I think we're seeing, you know, the public to, you know, the public markets to crypto markets, like where at some point you're going to have a company that maybe started as an equity backed company, and they're going to want to, you know, quote unquote, go public, but they're going to be more like they've already got earnings. They've got already got everything. And you're going to see someone like Binance come and say, well, why not just go public on Binance? Right. Like, and what's the model that Binance has already created? They have BNB, right? They've already kind of proven, it's like, well, what's the point of BNB? It's like, well, it's gas, you know, there's also the token, it, you know, you get discounted fees on their platform. You're telling me like that Binance can't be more competitive than like the New York Stock Exchange at some point with regards to an IPO? Absolutely, mm-hmm. They can. They might even be as competitive today. FTX, same thing. Coinbase, same thing. You know, so I think you're going to see some of that competition pushing and pulling. And that's what John, we've been talking about this from the beginning. We're always like, you know, hey, when is the first company going to launch like this token that's going to come over, and which direction is it going to go? Is it going to be AMC that now has like an ape preferred share? And like AMC went down 38%, but now there's this preferred share. It's confusing as shit. But what's not is just, hey, we're now relaunching on Coinbase.
Right. Well, yeah, now there's regulatory implications for that, right? Mm-hmm. That you know,
it's a security token.
That's right. Yeah. And I don't know how in terms of the KYC and, you know, accredited versus unaccredited investors and international and, you know, money laundering and sanction and all that kind of stuff, that all gets pretty tough pretty quick, and is going to take, you know, even in the bullish outcome, I feel like is going to take years to get through. And the, you know, there is this like interesting aspect of cat and mouse, right, that's going on with crypto and regulations. And, you know, it's, you know, I don't know how that's going to play out. It remains to be seen whether or not the cat and mouse game is going to go long enough that, you know, you're going to have like, you know, the entire S&P 500 represented synthetically on a DEX, right, at some point, and the U.S. government's just sitting there going, you know, we can't do anything about this. And does that just happen over a number of years? I don't know the answer to that. But that push and pull, that cat and mouse, that's not gonna stop. But it's also pretty apparent that, you know, regulators are pretty focused on aspects of this, particularly with the Tornado Cash situation. So it definitely is worth, paying close attention to. But, these are fights that the regulatory landscape for crypto has evolved a lot over the last couple of years as well, too. And the tail risk of something really bad happening from a regulatory perspective or a taxation perspective that's so damaging, that tail risk has gone down a lot over the last couple of years. It's like we were sitting here 18 months ago, early 2021, if we're sitting here going, are stablecoins going to make it? That was not that clear 18 months ago that the U.S. government was going to like allow for the proliferation of stablecoins. And now it looks very clear, right? And that in and of itself is like a pretty massive shift that has a lot of knock-on implications. But now we're fighting other fights in this Tornado Cash. This is another fight, and it's remains to be seen and has heavy political implications, right? Or I should say, the political landscape heavily affects how U.S. regulators are going to treat this. And at least directionally, the more Republicans you've got in the House and the Senate, I think generally speaking, the safer privacy is, seems to be the case. So also, that's just another dynamic situation that's worth paying close attention to.
Oh, I have a very basic question. What are you excited and bullish about right now? I'm not going to say pick any specific names or anything, but what gets you going in this space, waking up every morning?
Yeah. So we raised the venture fund after Axie Infinity, and basically watching Axie Infinity, watching Play to Earn, Scholarship, Guilds, providing a living wage for thousands of people in developing nations, seeing that play out, I got a clarity of conviction around the runway for that I have rarely gotten in my life. And that's not to say that it's not broken right now, because it is. The token model is broken. Axie Infinity was a poster child on the way up. It was a poster child on the way down. Stepin came along and took Play to Earn to, X to Earn. And then round trip the way up and the way down even faster than Axie Infinity did it. So these token models are not figured out yet, but I am very excited and bullish on that problem, making progress on getting solved. Anybody that's working in the X to Earn space, they have this problem written at the top of their whiteboard. Okay, there's a value accrual problem here. There's a sustainability problem to the token structure of this stuff. But I think that can get figured out. And I think that using a token to incentivize human coordination, both solely digitally in a kind of play to earn metaverse-y type of way, but then also incentivizing real world human behavior. Helium's a great example of that. Helium was before anybody ever said play to earn or X to earn, but Helium is an X to earn model, also a token structure that doesn't, it has some issues right now, but they're working on it really hard too. And I just think you're going to reimagine. It's like one way to think about it, like to just give you a glimpse into what I think can happen is like, if Stepin partnered with an insurance company and you got lower insurance premiums, if you were getting your steps in every day, like that, and it's like, okay, it's a simplistic idea, but it kind of gives you a glimpse into imagining like a whole world where there's a lot of different things like that happening. That's a world that I believe in. And then I think this metaverse situation, decentralized metaverses, because like one of the things that we've been asking ourselves as we've been evaluating, different early stage sectors and what do we think about them? The, you know, metaverse, play to earn, X to earn, you know, decentralized gaming, GameFi, all this kind of stuff is like just foundationally, where can decentralization have a chance to compete and actually win with centralization? And, you know, Joe, you brought up, you know, sort of like what Facebook is doing versus Sandbox. And we'll see how that plays out. But to me, the defining characteristic of that battle is going to be the Sandbox token. And what does the world think about that thing? And what role does that have in this metaverse? It's unlikely that Sandbox is going to beat Facebook on like graphics or like things that require an absolute legion of engineering talent. It's, you know, it's like centralization helps a lot with coordination on a number of different things. And so it's like, to me, I think this ecosystem probably needs to embrace the token because it's one of the defining differences between this versus centralized alternatives. And then we got to go, well, okay, what do we do with this thing? How do we use that to juice the flywheel of adoption? But then how do we manage the token economy in a way that you know, people don't buy the absolute pico top and then get murdered 85% on the way down? You know, Sandbox just went down 80-something percent in a straight line, right? And the daily active users in any decentralized metaverse universe right now is not good. That's not to say they can't come back, but you know, they don't look great right now. So these are all problems that you know, need to be solved, but there's really smart people working on them. And we're super excited to be able to jump in and hopefully be able to contribute over the next few years in this.
It's amazing. Well, who would have thought back in 2019 or 2018 when we were hanging out that we would be talking about play to earn and Axie Infinity with you, my man. But I love it. And I love, you know, the path that you've taken, and it's been fun to watch all your success. And we're always keeping tabs on all the newsletters and everything. So job well done, you know, shepherding in the next generation, my friend. So it's been a lot of fun.
It's the least I can do.
Yeah. All right. Where can everyone find you guys? How do they find Travis and Ikigai?
Yeah. Twitter's always good. Travis_Kling. And if you want to learn more about the fund, ikigai.fund, IKIGAI.fund. It's also linked on my Twitter. We've got a content depot that you can get to. We've got a bunch of stuff on there. I write this monthly update letter I've been doing for almost 4 years. That's goes out first of every month. It's got, you know, it's like 5,000 words every month. It's pretty meaty, but there's a lot of them. You can read all the historical ones going back. And then, yeah, appreciate the time. Enjoy the conversation. This is a good one.
Amazing. Have to give your newsletter a shout out, man. It's one of the best. Seriously. Well done.
Thank you.
We're going to have to publish that in a book. It's like Buffett with all of his shareholder letters. I think you're going to have to make that happen today.
I have, if you've read it, then you know that I you know, I begin every month with a Howard Marks quote.
Yeah.
And Howard Marks is one of the investors I learned the most from. If I was going to recommend a single investing book, the most important thing might be, you know, the one I would recommend because it's so profound and it's such an easy read and it's so timeless. But, you know, I have thought about that, you know, at this point, it's probably, I don't know, dude, it's like 500,000 words that I've written, or I don't know how many, right? It's like hundreds of thousands of words. And if I ever am in the mood to write a book, I can probably get most of it from just pulling stuff out of the last 4 years, because a lot of it's very topical, but some of it is kind of timeless. So,
yeah. Amazing. Well, we appreciate it, man. John, as always, thanks for being here. Everyone, audience, appreciate it. And we will chat with you backstage, my man. Thank you so much.